Blog Talk Radio.
Now, the laws that we had in the 60s was limited. But the next time, it would be unlimited, because the laws in the 60s was a struggle for human dignity and for human rights. The next struggle would be a struggle for survival. And it will not just be limited to black people or black or just white, but it will be the poor people, the masses of the people in the country, struggling for the right to live, for the right to survive.
Robert F. Williams was one of the original advocates of revolutionary violence on behalf of black Americans. Wanted by the FBI in 1961 on a kidnapping charge, he fled to Cuba and began publishing a series of propaganda tracts called The Crusader, which were smuggled into the United States through Canada. The Crusader declared that black Americans constituted an oppressed colony within the United States, a nation within a nation, and called for a violent revolutionary war of national liberation to free that colony from the oppressive yoke of racism and capitalist exploitation. He also had a radio program beamed into the southern United States by the powerful transmitters of Radio Havana. And in these broadcasts, he called for armed insurrection against Whitey and against Yankee imperialism.
Prepare the razor, the switchblade, the bullet, the gas bomb, and the match. Put the torch to the racist stronghold of the city.
Williams also traveled to Red China and became the honored guest of Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai. In 1969, he returned to the United States. At this time, the original kidnapping charges were dropped, and he was given a teaching fellowship at the University of Michigan under a grant from the Ford Foundation.
Now, the violence that we had in the 60s was limited. But the next time, it would be unlimited, because the violence in the 60s was a struggle for human dignity and for human rights. The next struggle would be a struggle for survival. And it will not just be limited to black people or just white, but it would be the poor people, the masses of the people in the country, struggling for the right to live, for the right to survive.
Peace.
Greetings. Greetings.
Everybody, mic on?
Yeah, I'm on.
Yeah, I'm on. This morning.
Can you hear me?
Is that Mr. Wilson on there?
Yes, sir. Good morning, Mr. Ellamine.
I need to come around your house.
Slow the dog. Watch the move, okay? You move.
I need to come around your house with a stick.
Peace and blessings. Gentlemen, how's everybody this morning? I'm good, Brother Tahan. How are you?
I'm doing great. Mr. Wilson, doing great, thanks. Can't complain.
Yeah. We missed you last week.
Yeah, I was doing Passover.
Yeah, I know. We figured you might have been, doing the festivities or whatever, you know.
Oh, yeah. Were y'all able to catch that last piece?
I heard about the kidnapping charges.
No, were y'all able to catch it? Were you able to catch the last piece we just played?
I did. I caught some of it. I heard it before about how the kidnapping charges were dropped against Robert F. Williams.
Okay, it was just a summary of it. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we let you take it from there.
Okay. So the last show about Robert F. Williams, part one, spoke about the Kissing case and how that brought a lot of bad press against the United States of America and the current administration at the time, the Eisenhower administration. Robert F. Williams' stature had grown tremendously. This is, of course, after he had a shootout with the Klan and whatnot, and the Klan was forbidden from ever doing motorcades through town again because of Robert F. Williams' efforts. So that was at the beginning. That was in the year, let's see, 1958 going on into 1959. So during this time, this is, of course, after the boycott in Montgomery, and Robert F. Williams, he started doing sit-ins as well, believe it or not. His sit-ins was a lot different, Basically, in his sit-ins, when he did them, he would be armed. He'd have a pistol at his side. His favorite was a .45, and sometimes he carried an Italian carbine. So those were his weapons of choice. And they would go to the place, like, I think it was a drugstore or a restaurant. No, excuse me, it was a drugstore. And they serve food and they serve fountain drinks and stuff. So what Williams was able to do was first show how to really do a sit-in and not get ketchup poured on you and being spat upon and being burned with cigarettes and so forth. He had a constant threat of violence against anybody who would come near him and put their hands on him and his crew. So his efforts made the owner of this drugstore take off the seats and made everybody stand up. So that's how he was able to defeat the local white businessman and getting some recognition for black folks in regards to being able to spend their money freely without being harassed. But also, another important question.
Was everybody armed or just him?
He had several of his followers, his most trusted followers, were also armed.
Okay.
Yep, so he had his most trusted followers armed as well. And everybody in his cadre, which, if I'm not mistaken, it numbered about 200 solid, hardcore men of war, even including young men as well, 16 years old and so forth. So they also learned how to fire weapons. And he would speak up on the Klan. The Klan was doing their rallies and stuff back in the woods and outside of Monroe. Him and his followers, probably about a squad of men, they would creep up on the Klan unawares and monitor their activities. So they would burn the cross. They had their rallies and so forth. Williams and his a squad of his followers would creep up on the Klan and observe them, kind of like what a cavalry scout does in the military. You creep up on the enemy to observe his operations. Williams was that bold to sneak up on the Klan to monitor them while they were having their rallies. So this is how bold this black revolutionary was. This we talking about in the late 50s. Early 60s, gentlemen. He was doing these type of activities. Another point where he was trying to get black folks a swimming pool, because the youth in his community, they were drowning because they can go to the whites only swimming pool. So the black folks, the black youth, their only resort was go to like a local creek, and they didn't have no lifeguards. And sometimes some of those youth they drowned because they didn't have access to the swimming pool. Robert S. Williams also instituted a sit-in, if you will, at the local pool, the Monroe pool. Of course, it was whites only at the time, and he'd have his weapons. And they would come there with their swimming trunks and whatnot, and they'd ask to swim. And they'd get turned around, pushing the issue, and they said, "Well, okay, so you don't want us to be in your pool. Okay, that's fine. How about the tax money that we also spend, the tax dollars we spend, build us a pool in Newtown, the black portion, the black section of Monroe. And they always refuse to build the black community their own pool so they could stay segregated. He was all about what was right for his people. So they didn't want him in the pool. Okay, we spend our money on taxes too. Therefore, take a portion of that tax money and build us a pool. But they never did. They never did. So that's just a factor in how when they say separate but equal, that's BS. Because if it was separate, if they were separate but equal, I don't think nobody had been really trying to integrate, to tell you the truth. Not to get off the subject, but if black folks would have had equal, separate facilities, then that was one of the sticking points of the civil rights movement. So if we'd have had equal but separate facilities, then we've been cool in the game. We've been cool in the game. So they wouldn't even do that. So basically, say again.
Go ahead.
Okay. So these are some of his his activities locally, and eventually he started going up to New York. People in New York started hearing about his efforts. Also, his local efforts were also a newspaper called The Crusader. He was the editor-in-chief, and he had a woman named Azalea Lee. They called her Asa Lee. And they had like a section called Did You Know? And it talked about things in the community. Like they would say, there's one white business that allows blacks to patronize them. They didn't treat them bad, nothing like that. They let them come in and spend the money. So they put it in the paper. So it was a way for the black folks in Monroe, but eventually also to other parts of the United States. His paper, The Crusader, it was sent out all over the country. It was a small newspaper, but it was sent out all over the country. It had tidbits on history, local history in Monroe, black history facts, and so forth. And also, Robert F. Williams was an avid jazz aficionado. Him and his wife, they love jazz music. So they talked a lot about jazz music as well. So during this time, the local authorities were trying to put an economic boycott against him to them, or then let take their money. So what he did was he organized boycotts against businesses that didn't respect black dollars. So what they did was they made sure that he couldn't work as well. So how he made money was with the newspaper. And in some cases, he would go out of town to make money and to work to support his family. And his wife also had a daycare. So they had a daycare that his wife ran while he was away doing work. So they found ways to support themselves, even though the economic boycott against him was pretty much enforced, yet he was still able, with the grace of God Almighty, to make money and to support himself. So he was an accomplished editor of a newspaper. And also, a very important point, fellas, is the fact that there were like warring black gangs in Monroe. Robert F. Williams, the gang warfare that they had, and he encouraged them to stop fighting each other and to fight against Mr. Chocolate. So basically a truce was called, and these young black gangs in Monroe united and became a part of the Robert F. Williams revolutionary crew. And of course, they also got weapons training as well, and a new sense of pride in themselves that their fellow brother ain't the enemy. It's Mr. Charles the enemy. So they use full exuberance, but they use against each other and turn it around against the true enemy, the Ku Klux Klan, Chief Monty, Jesse Helms Sr., who was at the time the fire chief, but previously Jesse Helms Sr. was police chief. And going back a little bit, one of the events of Robert F. Williams' life that really shaped him was when Jesse Helms Sr. had beaten a black female suspect in a crime. He beat her with his fists and dragged her down the street with her dress over her head. Robert was 10 years old at the time. The shame from the other black men that saw this whole ordeal, they didn't have the strength to do anything. And that really was one of the pivotal moments in his life where he decided that, you know, he's not gonna be like that. He's gonna be a fighter. So it's incidents like this that put that spark in him, that revolutionary spark, to fight against the powers that be. It started in Monroe, but then eventually it spread to New York, and it also spread to Cuba. And he had a statement. He referred to black people in general as the sissy race of all mankind. That was his disgust with black folks in general, especially the civil rights characters, where, you know, just turn the other cheek and let them fight you, let them beat you and abuse you and don't do nothing. There was an incident in, I believe it was 1958 or 59. And there was a young black mother. She was pregnant. And a white man got drunk and he tried to rape this woman. Now, there was a white neighbor that saw the whole thing. And she, they both fought that man off, and her white neighbor, another female, white female, she sheltered her, and they forced them to go to court for this incident. So the white man's lawyer, the Charlie's lawyer, put it like that. He had his wife, he had the defendant's wife sitting next to him. That's kind of unusual to have you're a defendant and yet your wife sits next to you. So before the trial started, the brothers of this young lady who was almost raped, they wanted to go cut this man's throat. Robert Williams believed in, at the time, he said, well, let's use the courts. So the lawyer got up there and he said, do you think that this man right here, my defendant, a good white man, and his beautiful wife, the pure flower white womanhood, you think that he would leave his woman for that? And pointed at the black woman he tried to rape. And the poor sister broke down and started crying. It's hysterical. And all of a sudden, there was uproar in the court because of that statement. The black folks in the court were ready to go tear that place up. They had to get order in the court. So they took that Charlie, that wretched scoundrel, and took him out the courtroom, out the back door. So the press put a microphone in front of Robert F. Williams. And the sisters in the crowd was angry at Robert F. Williams. They said, nah, you're supposed to protect us. Why did you let this man go? It's your fault. It's your fault he got free. Robert F. Williams said, okay. All right. He said, I see right now we can't get justice in this this jungle called Dixie. So therefore, any violence towards us will be met with violence. Any lynching against us will be met with lynching. And that was a famous quote that he quoted that kind of got him in a lot of trouble with the NAACP, because he's still the head of the NAACP, the same branch of NAACP that got a charter from the NRA. They didn't know they were black, of course. They were NRA members. They just, Robert F. Williams, sound like a Charlie name. They didn't know, so they gave him a chart. So the NRA had his back unknowingly. So when he said that, I think it was Roy Whitney, Uncle Roy, as Malcolm X called him, was head of the NAACP. And Roy Whitney, excuse me, was it Roy Wilkins or Roy Whitney? I can't remember what his name.
Wilkins.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Brother Wilson. So Roy Wilkins suspended him from the leadership NAACP branch in Monroe. And a matter of fact, after this, because it made national headlines, his statement. So Robert F. Williams actually had a debate with Martin Luther King. It was about nonviolence. And King, of course, was on the nonviolent side. Brother Robert F. Williams was, you know, saying, we got to defend ourselves. We got to be able to protect ourselves. You know, King was a hypocrite because King, during the boycott, he had black armed guards in front of his home in Montgomery. So, you know, so King was a major hypocrite in the fact that once upon a time, he too had armed guards protecting his home from being firebombed. But now, all of a sudden, he gets in the mix with the NAACP, and he kind of forgets that once upon a time, he too supported armed self-defense. So he was getting on Robert F. Williams' case and trying to tell him that, you know, you can't be violent, and we're small minority people, and, you know, if we fight back, then you know, we'll all be wiped out. And that was King's rationale as to why he was nonviolent. Robert F. Williams, you know, he stood his ground. He spoke boldly. And in so many words, he told those people, see, I will not crawl. I am a man. And a lot of people believe that Robert F. Williams won that debate. You know, Robert F. Williams wasn't necessarily college educated like King. King had a doctorate at the age of 22, 23. So for a man of not having a college degree to be able to win that debate, said something about his oratory skills. When he won that particular debate, he was taking our leadership of the NAACP branch in Monroe. So after that, the brother had to, he started going up north. There were allies up north that he became friends with. W.B. Dubois, Ozzie Davis, Ruby Dee, of course, Malcolm X. And they had like a, it was like a network, so-called liberals, black intellectuals. They all were supporting Robert F. Williams. These were some of the supporters of Robert F. Williams, which of course Malcolm X was his most ardent supporter, and he always sent money and machine guns to Monroe. Robert F. Williams became friends with Malcolm X. And the guns and the money kept being sent down to Monroe to support the fight against these redneck Charlies. And I'll pause for a moment, gentlemen. You have any questions?
Yes, sir. Kahan, Brother Kahan, I know further on down the timeline, I didn't get a chance to read the book on him, his biography, the book that he authored. I saw a few sound bites here and there. Looked at a video last night that said, showed Dr. King on a bicycle and said that he went armed and that he did, as you say, he did have armed protection guard around his home when he was staying in Alabama because of the death threats against him. And I was just, you know, and that was like you say, around maybe in the late 50s, 58, 59, something like that. And then I guess as the timeline went on into the 60s, he started really advocating nonviolence. But I think he always had some kind of defense around him. I was wondering whether I know you know the history of dealing with arms, Brother Kahan. They had what they call it, the deacon for the tent. Was that something that was around Martin Luther King, or was that in another area?
Oh, say it again, Brother Wilson.
The Deacon for Defense. Yeah, there was a group of church deacons that were went armed, you know, ex-military men, ex-veterans or whatever. But they were, a lot of them were deacons, church deacons, I want to say, from the black church.
Right.
Were those the guys that defended King, that protected his home, is that in another area?
Okay, Brother Wilson, deacons for the fence. In 55, there was no deacons for the fence. Those were just armed men, probably some military veterans. There was no, they weren't from a organization, organized group of black men. Deacons for the fence came about after Robert F. Williams, about 1960.
Oh, that was in the 60s. Okay. I was just trying to see what the timeline was. But let me ask you a question. As you asked us, was there any question? What was the incident that led to Robert F. The one thing that stood out when I did get some information about him was there's an incident that you said about the struggle and spreading to Cuba. I think he had to, him and his wife ended up in Cuba for a few years, didn't they?
They sure did. Yes, sir. Yes, they did.
What was the incident that led to what? They were charges brought against them. I don't know, conspiracy or what, but where they fled to Cuba.
Okay. I appreciate the question. Brother Wilson. That's a very good question. And this is the incident that led up to why he had to leave Monroe. It was like a cryptic quote. He said when the fire breaks out, there's no telling where we're in. So this was brought on because the whites were still trying to come into the black part of Monroe and shoot it up. They kept pushing. They was really, really pushing hardcore to dislodge Williams from his base of operations. So he was really fed up with this terrorism. So basically, this is what happened. This is the genesis of it right here. I'm going to go to the book, Radio Free Dixie, by Timothy B. Tyson. I'm going to read some excerpts from it on, let's just say, Williams is, how can I put this? His arson campaign, if you will. This was in starting in July 26, 1961. Says thus, just after 10 p.m. on July 26, 1961, flames roared through the roof of the Monroe Hardware Company's warehouse on Burke Street and lit up the night sky. When we saw this, Fire Chief Jesse A. Helms Sr. said, we immediately called out a second shift of 20 standby men. 40 firefighters pumped 400 gallons of water but lost the battle. Property damage totaled $125,000. Two nights later, an unknown person or persons torched the Union Supply Warehouse on East Windsor Street about 2:30 in the morning, a $50,000 loss. Okay, there was another attempt. Let's see, this happened. It was unsuccessful. This happened as well. Police held three black men for questioning. While they were in custody, arsonists hurled a Coca-Cola bottle filled with gasoline and stopped it with a rag through the black excuse me, through the back window of Monroe Seed Cleaning Company on Morgan Mill Road. Luckily for the owners, the flames licked through sacks of burgeoning burlap sacks that spilled enough dry grass seed to suffocate the blaze before it spread. So this was an attempt to burn down the Monroe Seed Cleaning Company, but it failed, unfortunately. About 1:45 the following morning, the crew on the freight train rolling into Monroe saw flames in the window of the Seaboard Depot and stopped the blaze before it took the building. The railroad workers heard the fire engines and brought help was on the way. But the trucks were bound for the L&M Trading Company on Morgan Mill Road. Fire bombs gutted the store in almost simultaneous attack. The next night, unknown arsonists completely destroyed the Monroe Fiber Mills, a small plant that prepared cotton waste for use in mattresses, and badly damaged the Downbeat Club, a night spot owned by a black school teacher who had written a letter to the Baltimore Afro-American urging readers to stop sending guns to Williams. These were the sixth and seventh acts of arson in 5 days. Authorities estimated total property damage is about $218,000. So Robert F. Williams led a campaign. I ain't even going to say terror, but maybe them charges was terrorized. He led a campaign of vengeance against these charges. And it says that every time the fire would happen, the white people would go to his house, and they thought they wouldn't find him there. Every time they went to go check in on him, see, is he there? Maybe he did it. He was always sitting comfortably at home with his family, enjoying dinner. So they couldn't put it on him because he was safely at home with his family. Somehow or another, some black folks, some kind of way, received a message some kind of way, start burning down these Charlie's establishments, and also burnt down this Negro bedwench, stopped sending guns to Brother Williams. So she had to feel some of that fury too for being Uncle Tom. Or Sambo, that's the better word, Sambo. So Brother Williams wasn't playing with these people. He wasn't playing. $218,000 in 1961 was a lot of money. So that was,
well,
that was the start. Sir?
Did they ever get proof that he was a part of the arson?
Nah, they never got proof, Brother Wilson. Never had proof that he did it. It was like an open secret. They couldn't prove
okay.
that he did it.
Okay. Still brought charges against him, right?
No, the charges were basically because of a false accusation of kidnapping. So this was during the time of the Freedom Riders. So the Freedom Riders came to Monroe. The Freedom Riders, it was integrated, and they came to Monroe because they were going to try to show Robert F. Williams that Dr. King's nonviolent method was a preferred method, and it brought results. Robert F. Williams, in so many words, said this. He said, I was willing to let them come on in, but I knew that stuff that King was talking was bullshit. Those are his words, the nonviolent stuff. He was willing to just let them come on in and observe how they did things. So one of the Freedom Riders was riding with one of Robert F. Williams' lieutenants. And these crazy Charlies came by and said some, called the brother nigger and stuff like that. So Edom, the white guy in the car, was kind of terrified. But the brother grabbed his pistol, and the white guy smacked his hand away. And the brother pulled that pistol out at them Charlies. And he said, yeah, I got something for you. And I got something for your mama too, mother And he pointed that pistol dead at him. And all that smiling faces, it just evaporated. And then the cops tried to murder Robert F. Williams. It was a citizen trying to run him off the road. And he had two young men with him. And there was a big crowd gathering. And the cops came, state troopers came, and they told him he's supposed to surrender his weapon. So he had a rifle and a .45. And he told the young man with him, it's time to use it, I'll let you know. So troopers came, tried to disarm Robert F. Williams to get him to surrender to the mob. Williams wouldn't do it. He pointed a pistol dead in the face of that trooper. It was going to blow his brains out. One of the young men saw that the other trooper was trying to come out the car. It was actually not true, it was the police. Tried to come out the car and ambush Williams. He pulled out that rifle and aimed it right at that policeman's head and threatened to kill him. All these young men and Robert F. Williams, these two young men and Robert F. Williams with weapons, and an old white man started crying, saying, God damn, the niggas, they got guns, and can't nobody do nothing about it. So old Charlie was like upset that these brothers had weapons, and they couldn't be taken from them. So state troopers came by, just two state troopers came, and pushed the crowd out the way. But if Robert F. Williams and his young men hadn't been armed, they'd have been killed by that mob. So Robert F. Williams always talks about how having weapons keeps you from getting killed by a white mob or lynched. Look what's going on. Freedom Riders in town. Freedom Riders get arrested. All of a sudden, he heard about people coming from, charters coming from South Carolina and Georgia. The Minutemen, I think the John Birch Society, hundreds, if not maybe a couple of thousand or more, charters was coming from those states to come and put an end to Robert F. Williams once and for all. They was coming to pull a genocide against Robert F. Williams and his community of Newtown and Monroe. So that was coming towards him as well. Then the Stegalls, a local racist family, earlier that day had went around with a sign saying it's open season on Coons. Somehow or another, they said they got lost and wound up in the midst of Robert F. Williams' followers in front of his house. Man, the black folks seeing them, Charlie, they pulled him out the car, and they said, let's kill him. Let's kill him. Let's kill these crackers. That was their words. They was going to kill him on the spot. Robert F. Williams said, listen. Anybody, he ain't killing nobody on the front yard now. So Mrs. Stegall, her big loud mouth ass, she's talking about, if you take us out of here, we'll be safe. So Robert F. Williams said, I'll tell you what, lady, I didn't bring you in here. I'm not going to take you out of here. So they was holding on to Robert F. Williams for dear life, because if it wasn't been him, they would have killed them two white people. There would have been some dead Charlies that day, that night, when this went down. So in the midst of all this, Martin Luther King calls him up, say they didn't want to talk to him. Robert F. Williams said, ain't got no time to be talking, man. It's a little too late for that, don't you think? Hung up in his face. So the Stegalls were basically saved by Robert F. Williams. He let them go. He didn't take them nowhere. He just said, let these charters go. Just let them go. And he let them go. So that was the genesis for saying that he kidnapped the Stegalls. It was a trumped-up charge against Robert F. Williams. They used that as a basis to say that he kidnapped these two white people, when in effect he didn't kidnap them. In essence, he saved their lives. So he decided to leave Monroe because the chief of police, A.A. Mauney, last name spelled M-A-U-N-E-Y, he said, Robert, called him on the phone, Robert, you caused a lot of trouble tonight. And in 30 minutes, the state trooper's going to come. You're going to be hanging from the courthouse square in town. The chief of police basically said, in 30 minutes. Robert F. Williams, he left. Him, his family, they left. They left Monroe. They had machine guns with them. They disassembled machine guns and threw them in the creek. And they took every back road they could until they made it up to New York City. And they were housed by a mixed couple. I think it was a Jewish fellow and his black wife, who also allies with Williams. But Williams had a very deep network of supporters in the New York City area. Charged him with interstate flight to avoid prosecution and kidnapping. The next day, the FBI came out with this wanted sign, and I got a picture of it somewhere. But it has him, has a picture. It has a description of him. They say they had some scars on his body. They accused him of being schizophrenic. And he said the reason why they did that was basically bring the stereotype of the crazy nigga. They ain't got nothing to lose. So they try to paint a picture of him as like a psycho or something. So they stayed, the Williams stayed with this mixed couple until finally they realized they had to get the hell out of New York City. So they fled to Canada. I think it was Toronto, I believe. And it was another group of allies in Canada that took him in, him and his family. Then all of a sudden, come to find out that the FBI enlisted the aid of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the RCMP. And when they realized that, Robert Williams had to get the hell out of Canada. Matter of fact, he found out later that the Royal Canadian Mounted Police had said this, so many words, that man hasn't got a chance. We'll send him back to the States in a pine box. They was gunning for that brother. You know, the monsters always get that man. They was going to kill that man.
He escaped from Canada and then headed to Cuba.
Say again? Say again, please.
I said he escaped from Canada and then he headed to Cuba.
Exactly. Now, my brother, I'm telling you something. This is the incredible part of the story. I read about it in his autobiography, Black Crusader. So the brother was like in the middle part of Canada. He traveled all the way to the west coast of Canada and went all the way down the whole coast, the whole west coast, all the way down into Mexico. And from Mexico, he made it to Cuba. And he had help because he was friends with Castro. Castro made a way for him to make it from Mexico into Cuba and freedom in Cuba. And that's how Robert F. Williams escaped to Cuba into exile. And go ahead.
How long was he in Cuba?
He was in Cuba from 1961 until 65 or 66, if I'm not mistaken. He was there during those years. And while he was in Cuba, he approached Castro while using a radio frequency, a radio tower, to broadcast his program, Radio Free Dixie. It was a radio program that was an hour long, like a variety program. His wife was a co-host, and they had jazz, that new jazz back in the early 60s, that real cool hip jazz, you know. And played a lot of jazz. Robert Williams did his commentary on the wickedness done in America against black people. And the communist government down there, they were okay with that because they looked at it as a way to, you know, because Robert F. Williams knew the country. The Cubans didn't know America. So Robert F. Williams was like a propagandist. He worked for his people, also helping out his allies, the Cubans, in the Communist Party. So he, until eventually, now check it out, though. This radio program, it reached the whole southeastern United States, from Virginia all the way on down into Texas, and as far away as California. That's how powerful that signal was. And I think every night at 8 p.m. on a Saturday night, I believe, the black folks were just waiting, just chomping at the bit to listen to Robert F. Williams' program, Radio Free Dixie. It was giving them more news than they ever could have gotten from the ABC, NBC, and CBS at the time. They were getting some real important news and information that they could use, you know, to educate themselves. So what happened was Cuba, there was some communist, Robert F. Williams believes that someone from the either the CIA or maybe some American communists infiltrated down there, and they tried to turn Castro against Williams and his radio program. They were saying things like, "But well, that music, that jazz music is imperialist Yankee music." And Robert Williams said, "It ain't got nothing to do with no imperialist Yankee. This is black people music." So eventually they started cutting down the power of his radio program, like 100,000 watts to less than 25,000. So infiltration in the Communist Party caused Robert F. Williams to have to leave, and he became a guest of Mao Zedong. Yes, sir. This brother, through the spirit of the Most High Brothers, he did stuff away from America than he ever could have did still living in America. As far as he was up there on stage with Mao Zedong in front of 2 million Chinese people. Mao Zedong let him and his family stay there as honored guests. He even did a documentary on Robert F. Williams and his family entitled Robert F. Williams in China. Williams was a friend of Mao Zedong to a whole crowd of Chinese people about the evils done in America. He did things that no black man ever could have did anywhere on this planet. By leaving America, he was able to meet heads of state of foreign countries that were adversarial to America. He even he spent a little time in Vietnam as well. He even got to meet the great leader, Ho Chi Minh. He became friends with Ho Chi Minh. Ho Chi Minh, when he was a merchant seaman many years ago, at the time, like in the early 1900s, Ho Chi Minh said he heard Marcus Mosiah Garvey speak on the streets of Harlem. And he was so impressed with what he heard, he emptied his pockets into the collection plate. So him and Ho Chi Minh with Kendrick, he met Ho Chi Minh, rubbed elbows with Ho Chi Minh, all by leaving America's strangling grasp. The Chinese let Robert F. Williams have even more radio time and resources to push his propaganda. They didn't even stand in the way. Brother Williams came out with a pamphlet called Listen, Brother. Came out during the Vietnam War. And basically, the brother was telling black folks, especially black servicemen, he said, listen, this is what you do. You go out there, you kill your officers. You pull a mutiny, kill your officers. You brothers coming back from the war in the NAM, go back into the black community and teach them how to fight and go kill these damn Charles. That's what Robert F. Williams was trying to do. That's what he was doing. Even away from America, he still was in the fight. He was still encouraging black folks from long distances to fight against the oppressor. Robert F. Williams. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. This brother, man. Yo. I got mad love and respect for Malcolm X. Don't get me wrong. Trust me, I do. I love that brother. I got a picture of him in at least 3 rooms in my home. Malcolm X said this. He said that Brother Williams was 2 or 3 years ahead of his time. Brother Malcolm did some great things, and Robert F. Williams took it to a whole other level. I mean, you meet the president of one of the biggest countries in the world, you know, at that time. Of course, they're not big enough. A major country at odds with America. You get to speak to 2 million of his countrymen. You get to do propaganda. Well, righteous propaganda. and bring it forth to the brothers and sisters in America so they can see what's really going on. You building up their spirits to realize they can actually fight against these people and win. Yes, sir.
I have a question. So, because I get asked this sometimes, I don't know the answer to it. I've been wanting to know. I don't know. I guess you can easily find that part. Who was the president when he came back, and how did he get the teaching fellow?
Okay.
When he came back, it's like they dropped the charge. Who was the president that dropped the charges? What was the conditions of them dropping the charges, and how did he get the teaching fellow?
Okay. Yeah, Brother Dawood, this is how that went down. Nixon was president at the time. This was in early 1969. So,
Nixon?
President Nixon.
Okay.
Sir?
Republican.
Yeah, Republican. Yeah, check that out, right? So, this is how it happened. Oh, very much so. Yeah, it is. It is. The people don't admit this. This is what really happened. Nixon needed inroads into China. He been wanting to talk to the Chinese for a long time to make inroads into China. They were kind of like sealed off, kind of. So mm-hmm. Nixon needed a way to make inroads into China, to meet with their diplomats and so forth, so he could talk to them and have talks and have diplomatic relations. Robert F. Williams was very intimate, of course, with Mao Zedong, Zhu Enlai, something like that. Apologize. Gentleman's name. So he knew these cats. He knew the top heads in the Chinese Communist Party. So inroads was made. He had a lawyer working for him in the States. And basically, he said he wanted to come back. He called North Carolina home. He wanted to come back home. He found a way to make a deal that if he could tell the American government about the Chinese, because he knew the Chinese very well, tell them about them, tell the government, U.S. government, how the Chinese government works, how they operate, their sticking points, things they're not going to put up with, things they're willing to talk about and work with. He did that, but he said, this is the deal. I do this for y'all. I got to come back to the States. And I don't want no charges against me or my family.
They wanted communist propaganda, communist information, because they didn't have it.
Exactly. Yes, sir.
And he cut a very good deal. That's one of the things missing, but we don't know. A lot of Angela Davis had to cut deals. A lot of those cats that got those jobs and started teaching, Melania Karenga, all those cats. They got those jobs, had to cut some kind of deal. So it's not nothing. I got to tell a lot of people, it's nothing to be ashamed of part of history. But the deal is, that's how it operates. Unless you're going to go live in one of those countries, you come back here, you're going to have to cut a deal. What's amazing is the question I always keep asking now is, do you still want to stay? He was a prime example. You ain't got to stay. Other countries love them.
Yeah. Oh, heck yeah. Yes, sir. Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
I mean, you really ain't got to say. You got some kind of skills, some kind of, you got something to do, man. If you can pick watermelon, you ain't got to stay. You know how to go to the field and pick a watermelon, and you don't mind eating like where everybody else eat. You ain't got to stay here.
Sure don't. Yeah, that's
you
right.
Go pick, you can go another country and get a job working on a farm and pick watermelons and get paid what they get paid, eat what they eat, hang out with them, learn their language, learn their culture. And then with your experience, you should be wise enough to keep moving up.
That's right. Absolutely.
You ain't got to stay.
You don't.
Well, cut off the psychological ties, he wanted to come back home. We're talking to Chinese and the Cubans. I mean, Cuba has got a huge black population.
Glenn, we talking about 1960. We ain't talking about modern day. We talking about 1960. Hell, I might want to come back home in 1960. We talking about the age of internet, FaceTime. I can be in goddamn. I was in Gambia, keeping track of what was going on in Wilmington, calling people and telling them. They thought I was here. I'm way over there. This is modern. This is modern 2000. You can be anywhere on the face of the earth and still be on your home with the children. You can watch. You can watch your graduation on FaceTime. Hell, you can be watching it anywhere. COVID hit again.
I understand what you're saying, Dawood. I mean, you're talking about modern time right now. I mean, you know, the internet is worldwide. I mean, you can interview somebody, like you say, you can interview me and be in Zambia. You know, and so, you know, with the FaceTime and the video and the visuals and all of that. But I'm just saying that the psychological ties that we have, why we won't even leave now, that we can communicate.
The psychological ties, the difference is, his psychological ties was family, commitment, being home, back to Monroe. Our psychological ties now is being able to go to the fast food restaurant and eat. psychological ties of being able to go sit in the toilet with some white folks or go to the mall and shop. And spend our money. Our psychological ties being able to have Christmas and waste our money. Our psychological ties being able to go to the club and throw our money away and watch all kind of indecencies. Our psychological ties is want to be whatever you want to be, but don't want nobody to correct you when you know biblically you ain't supposed to be there. That's what our ties are. Ties to this wicked ass system. That's what our psychological ties is. His psychological ties are totally different. This generation, his psychological ties is tied up to this beast whose number, I'm a bit like y'all now, whose number is 666.
That's right.
That's what we psychologically tied to.
We participate in our own oppression. We become a part of the oppressive game, you know? I mean, he worked a lot of centuries to totally dominate your mindset, you know, worldwide. But you know, there is no reason, as you stated last week, Brother Dawood, there is no real reason that we need or have to stay. Now, having said that, Brother Dawood, now that there's a push to move away from this wickedness and this system, all of a sudden they're talking about the dollar being weak. Our currency is weak now, especially in Africa, because the African leaders have rejected, you know, the monetary bribe that our leaders, our vice president was sent over there. So to try to bribe the leaders to go along with the alphabet game.
The only thing you do with the American dollar in a situation like that, you have to be wise enough to know the international banking system. Only thing you do is transfer your money over to the Chinese dollar and then bring it back to Africa the other way. you can move money around.
Definitely.
You have to be wise enough to study the system and move the money around. If you need to transfer money, if I know the dollar going to the Gambia dollar is going to be weak, what all I'm going to do is move my money to China. That's a simple move. You go get a bank account, move your money to China, or you can do it on the internet system with money nowadays and then bring it back over here. They just put that propaganda out there because they don't want you to go nowhere. That's the point I was trying to make. They want everybody to stay home because they need everybody home because this is post-COVID. They don't need nobody going nowhere right now. They don't need nobody shaking the book right now. This damn country is about to split itself in 2024 right down the middle. They need all hands on deck to keep this motherfucker together.
Trying to make, Dawood, all of a sudden, that now that, you know, I don't know what the audience is supposed of that's listening to us. But I just thought about it that for the last month or two, that we've been on this talk radio show, this blog talk, and you've been promoting and pushing, you know, to be an expatriate. All of a sudden, you know, and then it's just not just us, and it's not just me and you, it's hundreds of, it's thousands of people, like you say, leaving.
You know, I'm in a whole network, brother, got their own, I told you, Glenn, they got their own social media site. They get out of here. So they know, the people, they know. That's just propaganda, just what they teach you in the class, and I didn't know that. The brother told me the same question came up there. What happens when the dollar go bad? You move your money around. Do what the white folks do. Move
right.
Your money around.
Right. That's what they do. And they got their money in all other countries and islands and Swiss
yeah.
bank accounts.
And you can do it too.
Because
how you set
they have the power structure, and I might say the Caucasian people of wealth have been moving in and out of the economies of other countries for centuries. So, yeah, it's just that we got to learn the blueprint, you know, of how to do that. And you know, but I was just thinking, you know, it just occurred to me as we were talking, all of a sudden that you know, there are people saying that they don't think they can exist here anymore, especially people in our community. All of a sudden, the dollar goes weak because and that's one. That's a part of the psychological mindset. Like you said, the propaganda is because we are not financially mature, and we don't think we can survive without those American greenbacks. You know, and I guess it's called laziness on our part. One of the reasons, but. I used to listen to that Dr. Umar said, you know, we're addicted to materialism. And what's the most materialistic country in the world? You know, America. So, all those things that you listed, Dawood, is reason why we cannot, you know, focus on living somewhere else, you know.
Glenn, check this out. There was a group of people. There was a group of people, right? They sat there and saw this man that used to live with the enemy come back over there and be one of them, which he really was. They saw him go free them from bondage, marched them to a Red Sea, took his hand, they say, and outstretched the sea and went across the other side. And the scripture said that they saw him close the sea, and they said the weight of the Pharaoh's army, the armor that they had on, drowned them because they couldn't even swim to the shore because they had too much weight on them. Now, they saw this. About a month and a half later, these motherfucking Negroes, I'm calling Negroes, woke up hungry. And couldn't get nothing to eat.
They wanted to go back.
And they was trying to string Moses up.
Yep.
They was going to string Moses up. They was going to string him up with the law of God. And string him up because they got hungry over some food. And they just seen, they wanted to go. They started crying, let's go back to bondage so they can get some of them. Then let's go back. They was ready to go back to bondage because they got hungry and was uncomfortable.
Yeah, right.
If you tell me that ain't black folks,
that's black folks, all right.
They were eating watermelon and cucumbers in Egypt, man.
If you tell me that ain't us in scripture.
Oh yeah, that's us.
They missed the watermelons and cucumbers, man.
Yeah,
cucumbers in Egypt.
They was willing. They said, man, take us back to bondage. Can you imagine that?
I really can't, brothers. I was like, wow, man. It's like, I'd rather be a little hungry. Mosiah gonna take care of us. He took care of him pretty good. Let's have faith, you know. Let's have some faith here, you know. Don't be so quick to want to go back to Egypt and get whipped again. So get extra leeks, the extra cucumbers, and get that whip on your back again. I mean, it's like them niggas are silly. What you think was going to happen if you went back to Egypt? The ones up there was going to string them up. What?
You're going to get you done killed all their husbands and sons?
Yeah.
You going to kill your husband and son, and you talking about going back.
Yeah, man.
Like,
the Egyptian gave you all the gold and everything before you left, you know.
Exactly.
But, you know, I guess, you know, that's what I'm talking about, the psychology. It was a picture I saw on the internet. They showed these little slave girls or whatever. They had the gate open on the plantation. They had one side of the gate open. And they were standing on the other side with the bars. One side of the gate was wide open, swinging. You could go to freedom.
Standing on the side, holding
on to the bars. Same thing you said about no covers, Dawu. Think about that. You said when we were shipped over, and you're fighting, you know the rats and everything, and tied to each other, and swimming in waste and feces and vomit and sickness on the slave ship. Now you say, hey, in the modern era, the young brothers are going to jail like willingly. You know, they formed a community inside the jail.
Yeah. You know? They got their whole community.
That gang.
Yeah.
Got gang fighting each other in the jail. I mean,
they get out, go right back out. And like they know they're going back, so it's like, hey man, they get out for a minute, enjoy a couple of days, go right back out. I mean, I was just the other day in the paper. Now I just seen him. He just got out on a 3-4 year bit. He been out like 2 months. I seen him. I said, "Are you good?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "You saying you straight? You getting a job?" I said, "Come out the girl at Corning doing some people need some people to clean some floors. Give me a call. Let me see if I can hook you up." Next thing I turn around, this joke is in the paper. And he's selling everything. I mean, they caught him with 4, 5, or 6 drugs. I'm like, man, what you doing? Going back to what he know.
God. What he know? Jack ain't got no hope. You know what I'm saying? And see stuff like this, Saul, it's a lack of black leadership in our community. If we had Robert F. Williams in our community, this stuff would, I'm telling you, I know it's the modern era. It's 2023. Life is a hell of a lot more complex now than it was then. However, if we had Robert F. Williams in Wilmington, North Carolina, man, I'm telling you, things would change drastically for our people. You know what I'm saying? This is one of the statements he made in regards to black women and how they were attacked by white men and the genius and the purpose of it. It says, white violence against black women, he insisted, was not just an attack on the women, but a challenge to our manhood, especially to veterans. They have been trained to fight. The fact that white economic reprisals made it hard for him to support his family may have deepened his personal feelings. The violence one family, he insisted, was a necessary but not sufficient expression of manhood. Big cars, fine clothes, big houses, and college degrees will make a Negro a respected being called a man. He declared on the first page of the first issue of the Crusader, the newsletter that the Monroe NAACP marched in 1959. Williams denounced the emasculated men who preached nonviolence while white mobs beat their wives and daughters. When we passively submit to these barbaric injustices, he raised, we most surely can be called the sissy race of all mankind. And brother, the young man who he's trying to help out get his job, it's like, in a sense, he's somewhat emasculated.
Yeah.
He's somewhat emasculated. If not physically, then let's just say mentally, he's emasculated. do the things that he does, to not see the damage that drugs does to our community, and to not care. So it's like there's you know, Robert F. Williams started a 10-point program, right?
What's that?
Robert F. Williams started a 10-point program that the Black Panthers used to establish their 10-point program. He was the originator of that concept, Robert F. Williams.
He did?
See, the Black Panthers.
I didn't know that part.
Oh, yes, sir. Matter of fact, I have a book called Negroes with Guns. And this is the book that he authored himself while in exile in, sir?
Go ahead.
He was in exile in Cuba when he wrote this book. And this is a 10-point program. It says he actually had two of his crew that assist him in the writing of it. It says induce factories in this country to hire without discrimination. Induce the local employment agency to grant non-whites the same privileges given to whites. The welfare agency, the non-whites are entitled to the same privileges, courtesies, and consideration given to whites. Construct a swimming pool in the Winchester Avenue area of Monroe. Remove all signs in the city of Monroe designating one area for colored and one area another for whites. Instruct the superintendent of schools. He must prepare to desegregate the city schools no later than 1962. Provide adequate transportation for all school children. Formally request the state medical board to permit Dr. Albert E. Perry to practice medicine in Monroe and Union County. And that the deal with that was this brother, Dr. Perry, was a Catholic. And they railroaded him because he was friends with Robert F. Williams and one of his supporters. So they accused him of doing an abortion against a white woman. And they sent him to try and get him back to his position as a doctor. He was a great help to the black folks in Monroe. Employ Negroes in skilled or supervisory capacities in the city government. Act immediately on all these proposals and inform the committee and the public of your action. And this was offered and signed by Robert F. Williams, Albert E. Perry, Jr., M.D., and John W. McDowell. McDowell was one of Williams' top lieutenants in the struggle for freedom down there. And really what you would call the Battle of Monroe. So the Panthers concepts, they created their 10-point program. Robert F. Williams was, say again?
I said interesting.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. He was an influence. The Panthers became the Panthers because of Robert F. Williams. They heard about Robert F. Williams back in like the early 60s. You know, he was doing hell. Robert F. Williams traveled all over to California as well, if I'm not mistaken, at least once or twice. And matter of fact, he did a play about the Monroe the Monroe Revolutionaries. There was a play done about them and what they were doing, and that play was done out in Los Angeles. So Robert F. Williams' effect was pretty much nationwide, if not worldwide, influences that he had. The Black Panthers became the Black Panthers because of him. They say that black revolutionaries started in the South, especially Robert F. Williams. Nobody was doing what he was doing. Brother Malcolm was a bad man. Mad respect to the brother. I sure ain't trying to denigrate a man I really admire and love. But Brother Robert F. Williams was like, he was just influencing a great many young black men to take up arms and defend themselves. And that was nationwide. You know, he had admirers all over the world that supported him and his mission. And any black man can get young black men to stop fighting against each other. That's what I'm saying, brothers, that if we have, I pray to you, we have a Robert F. Williams black brother in this town, man, I'm telling you, that brother could get all the warring gangs, all the drug dealers to put that to a damn cease and join the fight against the oppressor. You know what I'm saying? That Robert F. Williams stopped young men like your brother just got out of the joint, and now it looks like he's about to go back. For a brother like that, these young brothers are doing that stuff. Stop this recidivism rate. Robert F. Williams today, Wilmington, North Carolina, or Richmond, Virginia, or Compton, or Los Angeles City proper. Robert F. Williams in them cities, New York, Chicago, Miami, Mobile, Alabama, Houston, you name it. A Robert F. Williams like brother with a spirit of Robert F. Williams and that fiery militant spirit. One Robert F. Williams in each of them cities, including this.
I'm working on an article. Well, I'm working on two articles. One is reparations for those that staying and repatriation for those that's leaving. So repatriation of those that's leaving. Those that staying, they want reparations. So those that are staying, when you say one Robert Williams, that's like looking for Jesus. I say we need to make Robert Williams. Our brothers need to become Robert Williams in order to get things done if they're staying. See, I don't mind staying if Mojo is going to fight. But if we wait for a Robert Williams to come, I'm out of here. Because I like my dad waiting for, if I'm waiting for another Farrakhan, nah, ain't no use me staying. What used to happen is we need to make some Robert Williams or become those Robert Williams ourselves and fight. That's the problem. The problem is finding enough of them that will fight because, I mean, you saw, like I said, we actually tried to do a gun club. It didn't take long for it to get scouted, and most of them was women.
It sure was, yep. Yes, they were.
What, no, brother? Right. Most of them was women.
Sure was. Yes, indeed.
Matter of fact, I lost the gun club because of that. That's a whole other story.
Oh, I feel you. You know what I'm saying? You're right. It was mainly women. You know what I'm saying?
Mostly women. That,
yeah.
Well, and Robert F. Williams, the gun club?
Yeah, the Robert F. Williams by a gun club.
You're saying the gun? Okay, the gun club. Oh, okay. Well, listen. I just want to say that I'm not going to say no dumb stuff like we are our own worst enemy, but it seems like that might be true in a way. But I know what the power structure does to hold us down, and they camouflage everything all the way to the point that they put certain people like we're just waking up. Some of us are just waking up to the fact that, you know, our black leadership, most of them are sold out for whatever reason, especially the religious thing. And it's a divide and conquer thing. I don't blame the power structure for what they do. You know, I don't blame the power structure for wanting to stay in power.
Hey, Glenn, can I ask a question?
The power structure does not share power. And see, there's a lot of things that we got to wake up to that we want us to keep our head in the sand, and they're not. They're never going to give us any equal rights here in America. You know, okay, in the 60s and the civil rights, okay, they closed our high school down and said, and assimilated us into the two white high schools. They closed a very prominent structure in the black community. Let's just take it, start talking locally, Williston High School, where you had a lot of black leaders that came out of, a lot of black athletes, you know, and they spread us all over the place. And one group, North Side, went to Hanover, South Side went to Harvard. And then later on, they created another high school, you know, Laney or whatever. But I was born by that time. But I'm just saying, you know, when you when you are just grains of sand, when you unite, which is the thing that the FBI fought against, J. Edgar Hoover fought against, who they said might have had black blood, then when you unite as grains of sand, you unite, you become a rock. But when you spread all over the place, you just grains of sand. You're powerless. When you follow the oppressors out into their neighborhood, because you can't live, or you feel you can't live safely or at peace in your own neighborhood, you become
right.
torn apart. There's not going to be any unit. And this is the thing, I understand what you said, Brother Dawood, because when you go over there to the motherland, you become, not that there's the great, they're that unified, they got tribalism and everything over there, but you become, one thing that does not stick out over there is your skin that makes you a target
right.
over here. You know?
Got that right.
The thing you're born
yes,
with that you can never change
hey,
that makes
you
a target. That makes you a target here in America. You know? Patrick Quest Wilson said that the oppressors, they go out in the woods and they go hunting. They're great hunters. And I don't know if this comes from, we can go biblical on that, why they're hunters. But they're great hunters. And they go in the woods and they go in the forest and they hunt brown. They hunt brown and black animals. And then they turn us into brown and black animals in the street. You know? Because, you know? So we got a game against us. And a mindset. These people have dominated the world for centuries now, and they've always taken over the land of the people of color. You know, they fought each other through, they enslaved each other through. Matter of fact, I'm seeing now, Brother Dawood, Brother Kahan, how now that there's some people are waking up. They're talking. Well, what if they woke? Woke is another word for black people now. Now that we're waking up, now it's other things that's coming up. I'm on the internet a lot of times. I'm on YouTube. I'm looking at all of a sudden, they say that the first person who owned a slave in America was a black man. Yeah, slave.
Hey, Glenn,
you know,
hey, Glenn.
Now the propaganda is coming out.
Hey, Glenn. Real quick, because we got about, I had to shave some time off, so we got about 6 minutes left. When you just said that right then, continue on that line about being woke up, because we got to be careful who's waking us up.
That's right.
Because a lot of the stuff we get, all these new woke people ain't being woke up by the right people. Because a lot of times this internet stuff is being woke up by internet. We need to get back to reading the books. Well, what we need to do is I'm creating a list of books that need to be read because this generation coming up right now, they reading internet and they being woke by the man. He's the one waking them up because he's feeding them what he want to feed
right,
them. We never like to read
right.
Right.
I mean, that was a going argument last night when I was listening to the Black Authority and he was saying that, you know, Roland Martin is talking about going to a new internet, get off of YouTube and go to Rumble. And the Black Authority, Jason Black, was saying, hey, the main thing you got to remember is that, and we already know this, that like Rupert Murdoch, that all the news and information that we receive off of that internet is being narrated by the oppressor.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
So, He trained the mind to think a certain way. And also, there's no active violence. We're in the age of information, but we're not in the age of execution. We're just in the age of information.
Going forward, what I'm asking y'all to do going forward, I want y'all, because that's what I'm at now. You notice I'm changing everything around. I need email lists. What we're going to start doing is we're going to tell you, get your email list together. Once I send you the show, send it on your email list. That way you know it got directed and it get tampered with. We're going to start sending stuff in direct. Even with my whole No Covers Gambling Mission, I'm just going to put ads on Facebook. You won't see me talking about much on Facebook no more. You'll start seeing me on email lists. If you're not connected, If folks are not connected to NoCovers.org, they're going to miss a lot of shit. Because it's going to be done on our network where we're going to be able to recoup the benefits from people tuning in on our network.
That's the magic word. That's the magic word right there, network.
Yeah.
Quick communication or whatever, internet or whatever, that's kind of dissolved the network of the serious people or the people that really want to do something, you know, because I can sit here in the comfort of my bedroom and talk to you guys, but I ain't doing nothing. But we're talking, we're sharing information, and we need some of that information. We need another thing. I heard about Robert F. Williams. I mean, you know, they have distorted history all the way back to Egypt. You know, they blew the noses off of the chain that said we weren't here first. The numbers were here. I mean, the lion doesn't get to tell the story. The hunter does. You know.
That's right.
If the hunter kills the lion, then the hunter tells the story. He can tell the lie. I mean, Sarah Dodd, what was her name? When she was in Hidden Colors, you say they just make up a story and they all unite. They tell it. They tell it to their kids. They tell it to us, and that's it. They ain't know whether the story is true or not. They just make up the narrative, and they all unite.
Last word,
say, this is what we're gonna say.
All right,
brother,
I get you next week.
George Washington never told a lie, and he never chopped the cherry tree down, and this is what we're going to believe. That's it. We didn't hear about George Washington. I didn't when I was going to school. I started school in 1960. I didn't hear that George Washington was a slave owner. I didn't hear nothing about it. I learned that stuff in high school. I was 17, 18 before I found out the truth about that. I didn't learn anything about the 1898, you know, uprising or whatever they want to call it. They got that two or three different names and that. I didn't learn anything about that until I was in my 30s or 40s. I didn't. I'm just saying I didn't. Some people say they grew up knowing about it. Their grandparents whispered about it.
All right, y'all can tune in next week for another episode of Support the Brothers. You can find us at NoCovers.org. NoCovers.org. To find different information about different shows coming up. As always, peace and blessings. Thank you for tuning in to another No Covers production.